there needs to be a background. What not to do.
Yeah. So too much lecturing sometimes about the same topic over and over again that he fails to do or to listen. Maybe the problem is not you talking. It could be something else, right? For example, if the child keeps, for example, lying, and you keep lecturing him about lying over and over, maybe get to the root of the problem.
Why is he lying? And he knows that lying is bad.
Yeah, he knows.
But he's doing it for a reason, obviously.
Yeah, obviously. So you get to the root of the problem. If your child, for example, is not smart at school, instead of just telling him off and stuff like that, try to find out why he's not progressing in school, instead of trying to explain to him how important it is to be a smart child and so on.
He probably already knows it.
He knows. The kids know. But it's a matter of us sometimes getting to the point of finding what the problem lies, rather than us just trying to lecture them about it. Because we always say with a lot of things are fitri, like it's in our innate. We know, let's say the majority of things, obviously depends on how you look at it, the majority of things are already embedded into us from point A, or from the first point of creation. Right. We know, for example, we know killing is wrong, we know stealing is wrong, we know cheating is wrong, lying is wrong. And we know all these things. We know they are wrong. We don't doubt them. Why? Because they were already programmed into us.
It's embedded in our existence.
Yeah. Mm. So we know these things, so that even with a child, he knows these things. But sometimes when you see the child is doing it, don't go lecturing him about it. Or going, you know, go on long lectures. Give him short, precise points to why. If it keeps happening, keep repeating itself, try to get to the point of the problem. Where does the problem lie?
Dear Said, our time for today's program is unfortunately up. Dear listeners, thank you for joining in to our program Islamic Upbringing. This has been your host Musa Al-Bahalili. As usual, if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, imageradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, Pars Today. Dear listeners, thank you for tuning in, and fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Face surveillance is so invasive of privacy, so discriminatory against people of color, and so likely to trigger false arrest that the U.S. government should not be using face surveillance at all, said one privacy advocate. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading Planned Expansion of Facial Recognition of U.S. Agencies Called Disturbing. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Digital rights advocates reacted harshly to a new internal U.S. government report detailing how 10 federal agencies have plans to greatly expand their reliance on facial recognition in the years ahead. The Government Accountability Office surveyed federal agencies and found 10 have specific plans to increase their use of technology by 2023. Surveilling people for numerous reasons, including to identify criminal suspects, track government employees' level of alertness, and match faces of people on government property with names on watch list. The report was released as lawmakers face pressure to pass legislation to limit the use of facial recognition technology by the government and law enforcement agencies. Senators Ron Wyden and Ron Paul introduced the Fourth Amendment Is Not For Sale Act in April to prevent agencies from using illegitimately obtained biometric data, such as photos from the software company Clearview AI. The company has scraped billions of photos from social media platforms without approval and is currently used by hundreds of police departments across the United States. The bill has not received a vote in either chamber of Congress yet. The plans described in the GAO report tweeted law professor Andrew Ferguson, author of The Rise of Big Data Policing, are what happens when Congress fails to act. Six agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, Justice, DOJ, Defense, DOD, Health and Human Services, HHS, Interior, and Treasury, plan to expand their use of facial recognition technology to generate leads in criminal investigations, such as identifying a person of interest by comparing their image against mugshots, the GAO reported. DHS, DOJ, HHS, and the Interior all reported using Clearview AI to compare images with publicly available images from social media. The DOJ, DOD, HHS, Department of Commerce, and Department of Energy said they plan to use the technology to maintain what the report calls physical security, by monitoring their facilities to determine if an individual on a government watch list is present. The report reads, for example, HHS reported that it used the facial recognition technology system AnyVision to monitor its facilities by searching live camera feeds in real time for individuals on watch list or suspected of criminal activity, which reduces the need for security guards to memorize these individuals' faces. This system automatically alerts personnel when an individual on a watch list is present. The Electronic Frontier Foundation said the government's expanded use of technology for law enforcement purposes is one of the most disturbing aspects of the GAO report. Face surveillance is so invasive of privacy, so discriminatory against people of color, and so likely to trigger false arrest, that the government should not be using face surveillance at all, the organization told MIT Technology Review. According to the Washington Post, three lawsuits have been filed in the last year by people who say they were wrongly accused of crimes after being mistakenly identified by law enforcement agencies using facial recognition technology. All three of the plaintiffs are black men. Federal study in 2019 showed that Asian and black people were up to 100 times more likely to be misidentified by the technology than white men. Native Americans had the highest false identification rate. Maine, Virginia, and Massachusetts have banned or sharply curtailed the use of facial recognition systems by government entities. And cities across the country, including San Francisco, Portland, and New Orleans, have passed strong ordinances blocking their use. But many of the federal government's planned uses for the technology, Jack Lapperkirk of the Project on Government Oversight told the Post, present a really big surveillance threat that only Congress can solve.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are three times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. They have organized in what is known as the Black Lives Matter campaign to get the message across that all lives are of equal value, no matter the color of the skin. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
We're just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation. I'm really glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout. But
get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
Yeah. I think that'll be powerful with it tied, like, on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, like the whatever size their shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there too. So it's going to, it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children because this is something that can't be argued. Like, even you can play devil's advocate, but these are children.
Exactly.
Children are harmless, so.
Tamir Wright, 12 years old, playing with a toy gun in the park. The cops roll up on him, and in 2 seconds, they have killed him. 1001, 1002, Tamir is dead. And this is not an isolated incident. It happens all too often, and it must stop.
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that this is something that I have to do. I have to do this. We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing. And he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the witnesses who basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun, and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other, so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together, the code of silence, and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters. Police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality in Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working peoples of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
State of emergency has been declared in the U.S. city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, since Monday, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, we don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from how it used to be. So I am going to head out there, see what's going on, see what I can learn from it, see how I can help, how I can support, but I just can't stay here in New York and not do anything at this point. So I'm heading out there.
Breaking news from Baltimore, a city on edge since the death of a suspect while in police custody, his spine nearly severed. Tonight, those tensions fueling violent protests now. Dramatic images coming in at this hour. You can see some people on the streets there throwing rocks and bricks at police officers.
On April 19th, 2015, 23-year-old Freddie Gray Jr., an African-American man, died in a Baltimore hospital after sustaining injuries while being transported in a police van. Gray had been arrested a week before by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police said was an illegal switchblade. Gray's hospitalization and subsequent death resulted in an ongoing series of protests. On April 25, 2015, a major protest in downtown Baltimore turned violent, resulting in 34 arrests and injuries to 15 police officers. After Gray's funeral on April 27th, civil disorder intensified with the looting and burning of local businesses and a drugstore, resulting in a state of emergency declared by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. The Maryland National Guard was deployed to Baltimore, and a curfew was put into place.
I went there expecting the worst because I had seen the National Guard on TV and I had seen like how occupied they were by the military. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but surprisingly, it seemed that they were protecting mostly the harbor, the downtown harbor. That's where all of the National Guard really was, and it seemed that that was what their attention was focused on protecting. I think the media tried to kind of instill fear so that the same thing wouldn't happen in New York, but with Baltimore, it was the young children not feeling heard. It was mostly young children. All of the programs out there are cut for them. There's really nothing for them after school or part-time job-wise out there. So these children, they felt unheard, and their thing was to take to the streets. They were emotional. They started destroying, you know, things that they didn't feel were beneficial to the community.
The narrative around Baltimore, first of all, was that it was a riot. And I don't like that terminology because it's an uprising. It's cause and effect. When people are living in pervasive poverty and homelessness and joblessness, and on top of that, you add to that the current political climate where we see, not that it wasn't happening before, but where we see an overabundance of cops shooting and killing unarmed men, that was a natural response to those conditions. As with every other protest that has happened throughout this country in response to this issue, there was a negative slant put on it. They wanted to paint these people as savages instead of looking at the cause and effect. And they also didn't focus on the days that preceded what they call the riot, where people were actually in the streets peacefully protesting. So of course they're gonna spin it.
On May 21st, a grand jury indicted several of the officers involved with Gray's arrest. But in December 2015, a Baltimore judge declared a mistrial in the trial of one officer after the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The images of police wearing helmets and masks, toting assault rifles, and riding in mine-resistant armored vehicles in Baltimore and Ferguson has also raised widespread criticism of what has been dubbed the militarization of local police forces.
Difference, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years, you've got the intense militarization of police departments. So the police department still engaged in arbitrary policing when I was growing up, but they didn't have the military equipment that they have now. And the very fact that what the last 10 years or so, every 28 hours, there's a black or brown person who's killed by a police or security guard.
I think that military-grade equipment should be allocated to police department, but never ever used against civilians. Military-grade equipment should be used in active shooter situation, terrorist attack, but never against a civilian unrest. And I, in my mind, it was a horrible error of judgment.
We need action. By action, I mean transformation of institutions. By action, I mean redistribution of the wealth downward. By action, I mean high-quality jobs, high-quality education. By action, I mean high-quality communities where people can live with dignity. By action, I mean police who are accountable, who are punished by law if they murder other folk, arbitrarily treat other folk in ways in which they ought not. So we're talking about just radical democracy. We need people's power. We need the sharing of power.
Unfortunately, I think that what we've seen with the killings of the officers in New York in 2014 and what we've seen in Dallas recently, unfortunately, I think that this is not the end of retaliation against law enforcement officers by certain individuals who feel that police profession and officers, no matter what department they come from, represent this oppressive and brutal treatment of minorities. After all, if somebody thinks about democracy and democratic principle and wanting to live in a democratic country, they have to realize that policing is a pillar of democracy. And if there are issues of concern, these issues of concern have to be discussed and have to be brought to the attention of the local politicians, but never, ever they should be translated into any violent behavior, especially towards the ones who overall are charged with the protection of all of us.
One major goal that we have is to tie federal funding of local police forces to a prerequisite that they provide data regarding their shootings, especially in the cases of when they're shooting unarmed civilians, and then also to tie that to the mandatory use of body cameras. So that's a huge goal because I think transparency is necessary. I don't think there's enough data out there, and so that's another reason why people are able to dismiss this issue. Another goal is to have an independent prosecutor to prosecute police in cases of police violence, especially against unarmed people, because I think it will restore faith for those of us who have lost it in our criminal justice system. People believe that the grand jury system is antiquated and leaves police to kill with impunity.
And so I think that this would be one way to help resolve that issue.
You know, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I protest? And because it's an ongoing problem, and I can pretend that it's not going on. I can pretend that it's not happening, but there will be a new hashtag to learn. There'll be a new face the next day. And so we continue to march and move forward and get more organized and get serious, because I don't want my children to still be marching. My grandparents marched. My mother was involved in activism work. And so I don't want to pass this along. I want to be able to tell them the story of how we overcame, how we were able to come together and fight this greater evil. And just, I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid, or teaching them to be afraid of police.
You don't know when the catalyst will be in place. Why did Rosa Parks become the catalyst as opposed to the earlier black woman who sat down on the bus just a few months earlier? It's hard to say when the spark in place takes off, the fire begins to expand, intensifies, and the next thing you know, you got a whole host of people on fire for justice. And lo and behold, people take off and it becomes contagious. You don't know when it's going to become contagious. It is contagious now. We are still living in the moment of Ferguson, Baltimore, and things will continue and I hope intensify.
I was told that I'm an activist from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow, to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? That when my daughter get older, this will still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, the brown lives, if black lives matter. That's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folk.
The Black Lives Matter movement, sparked by incidents of police violence, is an ideological and political movement fighting for black empowerment and equality. The movement has grown from the hashtag Black Lives Matter to include protests and demonstrations in every major city in America.
Well, for now, it seems that police brutality and racial injustice is not going to stop in the U.S. in the near future. And statistics show that many black Americans are skeptical that their country will ever make the changes necessary for racial equality. Perhaps only time will tell if America will ever be the land of the free. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another program. Goodbye for now.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Spirituality as Combat with the Self. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. My name is Muhammad Reza. In this session, I'm going to talk about one of the approaches to a spirituality that the Holy Quran treated. So today, we will study the ways the Quran treated the process of self-development. Actually, the Quran describes man's effort and struggle to achieve piety and spirituality as a combat with the self. So the first way is spirituality as a combat with the self. You know, self-building is an inner war. You have an inner enemy inside you, and you have to combat with and fight with him. Once the Holy Prophet said to the companions who were coming back from the battle that they had won, he states, "Marhaban biqawmin qadu al-jihad al-asghar wa baqiya alayhim al-jihad al-akbar." The Holy Prophet said, "Congratulations for those who have successfully completed the minor struggle, jihad al-asghar, but they have yet to engage themselves into greater struggle." It is amazing. The companions of the Holy Prophet, they were ready to sacrifice their souls in a battlefield, but still the Holy Prophet said, "This is jihad al-asghar. This is the minor jihad. And there is another jihad which is the greater struggle, jihad al-akbar." Qila ya Rasulullah. The Holy Prophet was asked, "What is the greater struggle?" The Prophet replied, "A struggle against the self. That is the greater struggle." So, in this process, the Holy Prophet described man's struggle and efforts against his self as against his soul, against his nafs, as a combat with the self. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z, and we're talking about the combat with the self. And in one hadith and in the Holy Quran, spirituality and self-development, self-building is described as a combat with the self. But the point is that the enemy that we have inside us and we are fighting with is the worst enemy. Why? Because what is the worst enemy? The enemy that we cannot see him, but he can see us. The enemy that we don't know anything about him, but he knows everything about us. He knows our strength. He knows our weaknesses. He knows every capacity that we have. So how should we fight with him? The answer is that we have to fight with him from the back. How? We should invoke to someone who can see our enemy, but we cannot see him. That is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala can see Satan, but there is no way for Satan to enter the divine realm. This is the way how we can fight this enemy. But unfortunately, we like this inner enemy. We like the enemy that we have inside us. And this is the bad news. For this, we have to invoke Allah. We have to follow Allah. We have to answer Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala when he summons us. So, for winning in this battlefield, this inner battlefield, we have to invoke to someone who can see our enemy, but our enemy cannot see him. Till next episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z on IRIB English Radio. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another listen, fi amanillah and God bless you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
America has an accountability problem. In fact, if the COVID-19 disaster, the January 6th Capitol attack, and the Trump years are any indication, the American lexicon has essentially dispensed with the term accountability. This should come as no surprise. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Karen Greenberg, writer. This article is published under the heading America's Accountability Problem. Stay tuned for more. America has an accountability problem. In fact, if the COVID-19 disaster, the January 6th Capitol attack, and the Trump years are any indication, the American lexicon has essentially dispensed with the term accountability. This should come as no surprise. After all, there is nothing particularly new about this. In the Bush years, those who created a system of indefinite offshore detention at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, those who implemented the CIA global torture program and the National Security Agency's warrantless surveillance policy, not to mention those who purposely took Americans to war based on lies about non-existent Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, were neither dismissed, sanctioned, nor punished in any way for obvious violations of the law. Nor has Congress passed significant legislation of any kind to ensure that all encompassing abuses like these will not happen again. Now, early in the Biden era, any determination to hold American officials responsible for such past wrongdoing, even the president who helped launch an assault on the Capitol, seems little more than a fantasy. It may be something to discuss, rail against, or even make promises about, but not actually reckon with. Not if you're either a deeply divided Congress or a Department of Justice that has compromised itself repeatedly in recent years. Under other circumstances, of course, those would be the two primary institutions with the power to pursue genuine accountability in any meaningful way for extreme and potentially illegal government acts. Today, if thought about at all, accountability, whether in the form of punishment for misdeeds or meaningful reform, has been reduced to a talking point. With that in mind, let's take a moment to consider the Biden administration's approach to accountability so far. Even before Donald Trump entered the Oval Office, the country was already genuinely averse to accountability. When President Obama took office in January 2009, he faced the legacy of the George W. Bush administration's egregious disregard for laws and norms in its extra-legal post-9/11 so-called war on terror. From day one of his presidency, Obama made clear that he found his predecessor's policies unacceptable by both acknowledging and denouncing those crimes. But he insisted that they belonged to the past, fearing that the pursuit of punishment would involve potentially ugly encounters with former officials and would seem like political retribution in a country increasingly divided and on edge. He clearly decided that it wouldn't be worth the effort. Ultimately, as he said about interrogations, detentions, and so forth, it was best for the U.S. to look forward as opposed to looking backward. True to the president's word, the Obama administration refused to hold former officials responsible for violations of fundamental constitutional and legal issues. Among those who escaped retrospective accountability were Vice President Dick Cheney, who orchestrated the invasion of Saddam Hussein's Iraq based on lies, the lawyer in the Justice Department's official of legal counsel, John Hu, who in his infamous torture memos justified the enhanced interrogation of so-called war on terror prisoners, and Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld, who created a Bermuda Triangle of injustice at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. In terms of reform, Obama did ensure a degree of meaningful change, including decreeing an official end to the CIA torture of prisoners of war. But too much of what happened remained unaddressed and lay in wait for abuse at the hands of some irresponsible future president. As a result, many of the sins that were at the heart of the never-ending response to the 9/11 attacks have become largely forgotten history, leaving many potential crimes unaddressed. And even more sadly, the legacy of accountability's demise only continues. Biden and his team entered office facing a brand new list of irregularities and abuses by high-ranking officials, including President Trump. In this case, the main events demanding accountability had occurred on the domestic front: the January 6th insurrection, the egregious mishandling of the pandemic, and the interference in 2020 presidential election, and also the use of Department of Justice for political ends all awaited investigation after Inauguration Day. At the outset, the new government dutifully promised that some form of accountability would indeed be forthcoming. On January 15th, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced that she planned to convene an independent commission to thoroughly investigate the Capitol riots, later pledging to look into facts and causes of that assault on Congress. Attorney General nominee Merrick Garland similarly promised, "If confirmed, I will supervise the prosecution of white supremacists and others who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. Meanwhile, signaling some appetite for holding his predecessor accountable during the presidential campaign, Joe Biden had already ruled out the possibility of extending a pardon to Donald Trump. In that way, he ensured that were he elected, numerous court cases against the president and his Trump organization would be open to prosecution. Even as Noah Bookbinder, the executive director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, recently suggested, reviving of the obstruction of justice charges that had been central to the Mueller investigation of 2016 presidential election. Six months after Joe Biden took office, there has been no firm movement toward accountability by his administration. On the question of making Donald Trump and his allies answer for their misdeeds, the appetite of this administration so far seems wanting, notably, for example, when it comes to the role of president may have played in instigating the Capitol attack. Sadly, Pelosi's call for an independent commission to investigate that insurrectionary moment passed the House but fell victim last month to the threat of a filibuster and was blocked in the Senate. Trump's disastrous mishandling of the pandemic, potentially responsible for staggering numbers of American deaths, similarly seems to have fallen into the territory of unaccountability. The partisan divisions of Congress continue to stall a COVID-19 investigation. National security expert and journalist Peter Bergen, for instance, called for a commission to address the irresponsible way the highest levels of government dealt with the pandemic, but the idea failed to gain traction. It matters not at all that numerous journalists, including Lawrence Wright, Michael Lewis, and Nicholson Baker, have impressively documented the mishandling of the pandemic in the United States. Such disastrous acts included early denials of lethality of the disease, the disavowal of pandemic perpetrators' plans, the dismantling of the very government office meant to respond to pandemics, the presidential promotion of quick cures, a disregard for wearing masks early on, and so much else, all of which contributed to a generally chaotic governmental response in the U.S., which ultimately cost tens of thousands of lives. In truth, a congressional investigation into either the Capitol riots or the Trump administration's mishandling of the pandemic might never have led to actual punitive accountability. After all, 9/11 Commission touted as the gold standard for such investigations did nothing of the sort. While offering a reputable history of the terror threat that resulted in the attacks of 9/11/2001, and a full-scale summary of government missteps and lapses that led to that moment, the 9/11 report did not take on the mission of pointing fingers and demanding accountability. In a recent interview with former New York Times reporter Philip Shannon, whose 2008 book, The Commission, punctured that group's otherwise stellar reputation, just security editor Ryan Goodman offered this observation. An important lesson from your book is the conscious trade-off that 9/11 Commission members made in prioritizing having a unanimous final report, which sacrificed their ability to promote the interest of accountability, such as identifying and naming senior government officials whose acts or omissions were responsible for the lapses in U.S. national security before the attack. Shannon added that trade-off between accountability and unanimity was acknowledged by Commission staff members frustrated by the absence of what thought should have been the report's most important and controversial conclusions. And signs of the difficulty of facing any kind of accountability are now evident inside the Department of Justice, too. Despite initial rhetoric to the contrary from Attorney General Merrick Garland, the department has shown little appetite for redress when it comes to those formerly in the highest post. And that reality should bring to mind the similar reluctance of Barack Obama, the president who originally nominated Garland unsuccessfully to the Supreme Court. For anyone keeping a scorecard of DOJ actions regarding Trump-era excesses, the record is slim indeed. While the department did at least abandon any possible prosecution of former National Security Advisor John Bolton for supposedly disclosing classified information in his memoir in his time, in the Trump administration, Garland also announced that he would not pursue several matters that could have brought to light information about President Trump's abuse of power. In May, for instance, the department appealed a court order called for the release of the full version of a previously heavily redacted DOJ memo advising then-Attorney General Bill Barr. that the evidence in the Mueller report was not sufficient to support a conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt that the president violated the obstruction of justice statuses. In fact, the Mueller report did not exonerate Trump, as Mueller himself would later testify in Congress, and as hundreds of federal prosecutors would argue in a letter written in the wake of the report's publication, saying, "Each of us believes that the conduct of President Trump described in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report would result in multiple felony charges for obstruction of justice."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris has arrived in Vietnam as she continues a tour of Southeast Asia in an attempt to co-opt countries against China. Speaking in Hanoi on Wednesday, Harris said that there was a need to increase pressure on Beijing over its maritime claims in the South China Sea. She offered Vietnamese President's support to counter Beijing in the South China Sea. "We need to find ways to pressure, raise the pressure on Beijing to abide by the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, and to challenge its bullying and excessive maritime claims." Speaking in Singapore one day earlier, Harris had said that Beijing's use of what she called scare tactics in the South China Sea continued to undermine what she described as a rules-based order and threatened the sovereignty of other regional nations. Laying out the U.S. administration's foreign policy goals, Harris reiterated that Washington had enduring interests in the Indo-Pacific region and aimed to counter Beijing's aggressive advances, as well as to maintain freedom of navigation. Harris sought to assure America's Southeast Asian allies that growing U.S.-China tensions would not force nations that have strong ties with both countries to choose one side of the political equation. She said, however, that Washington would take the side of its allies in all of their territorial disputes with China.
"Our vision includes freedom of navigation, which is vital to us all. The livelihood of millions of people depend on the billions of dollars in trade that flow through these sea lanes each day."